Supreme Court gives more rights to corporations and less rights to you and me. How do we stop the Supreme Court? Coming up next. And welcome to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition for July 3rd, 2013. On the Ground lifts up voices of activists and activism here in the nation's capital. I'm your host, Esther Averam. Well, today I'd like us all to think about pressing issues and campaigns, be they local, national, or international, that we can get behind as a station, as a community. And with two rulings this week that strike a blow at the rights of women and labor, many are asking, what can we do about the right-wing gang on the Supreme Court that is giving corporations more and more power and taking away rights of people, especially women? I want you to think about these two issues, key campaigns that we must get behind as a community, and how can we end the reign of this rogue Supreme Court? We'll speak to Gerald Horn, Bill Fletcher, and Dr. Linda Prine in the first hour of the show and take your calls beginning at the bottom of the hour. But first, other news making headlines. Of course, one campaign I want us to get behind is the movement and big rally against fracking in our own backyard. On July 13th, environmentalists from around the region and nation will gather here in Washington, D.C. to oppose construction of a massive export terminal for natural gas at Cove Point, Maryland, one of 20 such export facilities being considered by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and the only one adjacent to a residential neighborhood. Oil and gas companies propose to use controversial drilling, fracking, in communities up and down the East Coast, then pipe the gas to Cove Point where it will be processed and shipped around the world. The rally is July 13th, 12:30 to 3:30 p.m. It begins west of the U.S. Capitol Reflecting Pool on the National Mall. Meet at the intersection of 3rd Street Northwest and Madison Drive Northwest in Washington, D.C. For more information about July 13th, visit ChesapeakeClimate.org or StopGasExports.org. Now, related to our ongoing coverage of fracking and our environment, a new review has found that the Obama administration is failing to inspect 4 out of 5 new higher-risk oil and gas wells. The Associated Press reports the Bureau of Land Management has been overwhelmed by a surge in fracking and has not been able to keep pace with inspecting high-priority wells, including those near national forests or fragile watersheds. A former BLM field officer called the situation a disaster waiting to happen. And in an environmental victory, New York's highest court has upheld the right of local towns and cities to ban fracking. Fracking is currently barred in New York under a 2008 moratorium, but more than 75 towns have blocked it in case New York Governor Andrew Cuomo lifts the ban. New York City has finalized a $40 million settlement with the Central Park Five, who were wrongly convicted of raping a female jogger in Central Park 25 years ago. The five black and Latino men were convicted as teenagers. Media coverage at the time portrayed them as guilty and used racially coded terms to describe them, but their convictions were vacated in 2002 when the real rapist came forward and confessed, after the five had already served jail terms of up to 13 years. The State Department abandoned a probe of the private military firm Blackwater in Iraq after a company official threatened to kill the government's chief investigator. The New York Times reports investigators began looking into Blackwater's Iraq operations just weeks before the company operative shot dead 17 Iraqi civilians in the 2007 massacre near Baghdad's Nisour Square. The investigators found widespread misconduct, but according to government documents, the investigation was squashed after Blackwater's project manager in Iraq, Daniel Carroll, issued a threat that he could kill the chief investigator, Gene Richter, and no one could or would do anything about it because they were in Iraq. The U.S. Embassy in Iraq ended up siding with Blackwater, ordering Richter and a colleague to leave the country and calling them unsustainably disruptive and unnecessarily hostile to contract personnel. The trial of 4 Blackwater operatives accused in the massacre began this month after years of delay. And there is a Don't Buy Staples movement that is gaining momentum around the country that we may want to get behind. After the U.S. Postal Service struck a no-bid deal with Staples to operate postal counters in 82 Staples stores and to provide nearly all the services the U.S. post offices provide. At the same time, the Postal Service is closing dozens of traditional post offices and eliminating jobs. Dina Briscoe, president of the American Postal Workers Union, said, quote, "We believe the American people have a right to post offices staffed by highly trained, uniformed postal employees, employees who have taken an oath to safeguard the privacy and security of their mail," end quote. Several unions, including the D.C. Metro Council of the AFL-CIO and community organizations around the country who are signing on to the campaign, say that the new business arrangement replaces living wage jobs with high turnover, low wage jobs at Staples. And finally, yesterday marked the 50th anniversary of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which ended unequal application of voter registration requirements and racial segregation in schools, places of employment, and in public accommodations. Timothy Jenkins, a veteran organizer of Freedom Summer in Mississippi, told a recent gathering of young people here in D.C. at the African American Civil War Museum not to assume that the civil rights movement is over. We'll play his full remarks.
One of the current myths is that the civil rights movement is over. But if you read the newspapers, you'll see that that's a lie. In the state of North Carolina, they're now enacting legislation that will prevent people from registering before the election. They changed the laws so that people can't register on the day before. It has to be a week before. They've raised other kinds of problems that have affected other states, not just Mississippi, but places like Arizona, places like Utah. You must not think that the struggle of the 60s is over. As long as there are people who want to control power for their personal benefit and for the benefit of their families, for the benefit of their neighbors, for the benefit of the people who look like them, or the people who have the same income that they have, the movement is not over. And one of the things I happened to be doing was going through some old tapes that I had made from my little battery-driven Hitachi recorder. And I made those tapes in 1962 and 1963. And I listened to them and I listened to the songs. And what I really had satisfaction was that we were better than we knew. And I think that's the important thing to remember, that we can be better than we know. And the challenge of the next generation is to be better than you think you are. But let's remember why Freedom Summer was important and why it succeeded. We made a decision, Bob Moses, Charlie Jones, Charlie Sherrod, Chuck McDew, that as long as black people were being brutalized and being killed and locked up, the country wouldn't care. That we had to take an initiative to get some white people hurt and get some white reporters down there to cover the news and get on nightly news and make people know that this is not a peculiar problem that only affects black people. One of the unsaid things was that when we started the movement in Mississippi for black people, there was supposed to be a parallel movement run by the Northern Student Movement, the Students for Democratic Society, to go into the white community and do what we were doing in the black community. The white community still needs that movement. Anytime people will vote against their own interest on health care, vote against their own interest in education, vote against their own interest in the business of property rights, it indicates that white people still are yet to be reached by their movement. And one of the things I hope will happen in the next generation is that people will be mobilized to go to the white South like we were mobilized to go to the black South. Because until we liberate the white people from the stupidity and the backwardness and the ethnocentricity that they suffer from as a disease, will not be a liberated country. So this is not a celebration of what has been accomplished. This is a date for commitment to what we have yet to do. We can be better than we think we are. We did it once, and we can do it again.
You just heard the voice of Timothy Jenkins, a veteran of Freedom Summer, speaking at a recent gathering marking the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer held at the African American Civil War Museum. And those are our headlines for July 3rd, our pre-4th of July edition of On the Ground. When we come back, why the Supreme Court's decisions this week are so dangerous to all of us and what we can do about it. We'll be back in a minute after this music from 1964.
You know you're out of sight. Sweet disposition. Oh, you're always right. You got a sweet disposition. You know you're always right. You know just what you're doing, baby. You know you're out of sight.
Welcome back to the Thursday edition of Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Esther Averam. You just heard Out of Sight by James Brown, which was released 50 years ago in July of 1964 during Freedom Summer. Well, as you know, shifting back to our current day struggles, battles, this week the Supreme Court ruled in two cases that impact both health care and the rights of working people in Burwell versus Hobby Lobby. The court ruled that most private companies that claim religious objections can refuse to provide contraceptives as required by the Affordable Care Act. In the 5-4 ruling opposed by all three women on the court, the justices ruled that requiring so-called closely held corporations to pay for contraception violates a federal law protecting religious freedom. The title closely held corporation applies to about 90% of U.S. businesses. And in Harris versus Quinn, the Supreme Court voted 5-4 to legalize free riders. Basically, the court ruled that even though a majority of home care providers in Illinois voted to join the Service Employees International Union, Illinois cannot require them to pay union dues, which cover costs of collective bargaining and contract administration, even though the worker benefits from the collective bargaining. At least 20 other states have similar arrangements where government workers whom the union represents but who do not wish to join must pay agency fees. So do many local governments. Justice Elena Kagan wrote in her dissent that there could be a mass exodus from the unions, not just of the agency fee payers, but of members. The laws of economics letting them be free riders while still compelling unions to represent them would lead to those departures, she predicted. With me this morning to discuss the impact of these rulings and the way forward are three guests. On the line is the prolific author and activist Gerald Horn, who is professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston, a frequent commentator on the Pacifica Network. His newest book is Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow. Many of our listeners probably don't know that Professor Horn is also an attorney. Good morning, Gerald.
Good morning to you.
And joining me on the line from New York is Dr. Linda Prine, medical director of the Reproductive Health Access Project, of which she is a co-founder. She also sits on the board of the New York Metro Chapter of Physicians for a National Health Program. Good morning, Dr. Prine.
Hi there.
Okay. And joining me here in the studio is Bill Fletcher, labor and international activist and author, including author of the book They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions, Dispelled Myths About Unions and the Labor Movement. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
Everyone, thank you for joining On the Ground this morning. Let's start with Hobby Lobby and with you, Dr. Prine. There's so many things wrong with this ruling from the perspective of science and medicine. The fact that Hobby Lobby's claims about birth control methods are not true, that Hobby Lobby invests in companies that produce the forms of birth control in question, that Hobby Lobby pays for male procedures like vasectomy, and some even cite the fact that Hobby Lobby sells items made in China where there is forced abortion. But from your perspective, what is the biggest problem with the Hobby Lobby ruling?
Well, all of the points that you mentioned are really key, as well as just the fact that it undermines what has actually been a great public health achievement. Contraception for women is such a breakthrough event that's occurred in the last 50 years. It really enables women to participate in the workforce and control their own bodies and have their babies when they want them and space them in a way that's healthy for the babies. It reduces maternal mortality and has been correlated with many improved health and economic benefits for families and communities. So making access to birth control more difficult and more expensive is just such a step backwards for women.
You know, after the ruling, I saw a statement from you, and you said, you know, why should the religion of one's boss determine what birth control products a woman has to choose from? It should be none of their business. Now, I know you practice as a family physician as well as a gynecologist. So what are some of the practical impacts that you anticipate from the ruling?
Well, in New York State, we do have mandated coverage of contraception, so it's not going to be an issue in our state, but I believe in many states across the country, especially where the Affordable Care Act isn't even, and the Medicaid expansion isn't even happening, this is going to be just one more nail in the coffin for women regarding their reproductive freedom. There's so many barriers for women being able to access birth control. The pills themselves cost $50 a month now in many places, and to get an IUD or an implant or the long-acting methods that work the best cost not only a doctor's office visit, but the payment for the device, which in this country, because it's not subsidized, unlike really every other country in the world, including very poor countries, subsidized long-acting contraceptives like IUDs, it can cost $800 to $1,000 to get an IUD.
Wow.
So this is just such a barrier for women without good health insurance, and this ensures that many employers can make sure that women do not have good health insurance.
Wow. Okay, Gerald, I want to turn to you next. The legal experts that I have heard range from concerned to alarmed by the fact that this ruling gives corporations the right to have a religion and makes that right superior to the rights of women. I mean, what do you have to say about that? And from your perspective, what is the most important thing about this Hobby Lobby case?
Well, tomorrow many people will be marking July 4th, that is to say the formation of the United States of America. And one of the principles I had thought that the United States was founded upon was seeking to have a formal ceasefire with regard to the religious wars that had bedeviled Europe for decades and centuries. That was embodied in the First Amendment. But now it seems that the U.S. Supreme Court is trying to take this country backwards, that is to say backwards not only to the 19th century, but before 1776. This idea that corporations, so-called closely held corporations, which by the way includes major entities such as Bloomberg News, for example, and other billion-dollar corporations, somehow have rights, somehow have personhood, is quite dangerous, and it opens the door to all manner of travesties. Even though Justice Alito, in his majority opinion, tried to cabin off the idea that a corporation could say that observing anti-Jim Crow laws violated his religion, rather curiously and conspicuously, he had nothing to say about anti-gay laws. And we all know that in the pipeline or a number of cases, for example, that might suggest that a wedding photographer is not duly bound to snap pictures at a same-sex marriage ceremony, for example. there are all sorts of ideas, rather ridiculous ideas, I might add, that somehow could be extended by the Hobby Lobby decision to sanction bigotry in Jim Crow. It's very dangerous.
Yeah. Actually, as soon as I heard about that case, it made me think about those same examples that you cite. Also, because we are marking the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer, and we're talking about, you know, not that long ago, you know, segregation being legal in the South, and people having very closely held religious beliefs in the South that they connected to their racism, that they connected to the discrimination against black people. So that certainly raised my eyebrow. Now, Bill, Sarah Jaffe, writing for In These Times, penned an article titled "Why Harris and Hobby Lobby Spell Disaster for Working Women." In it, she lumps together both of this week's Supreme Court rulings, and I'm going to try to merge them together right now, too, and add Harris versus Quinn to our discussion. So do you agree with her assessment? And if so, how do you think both of these rulings are particularly damaging to women in particular and labor in general?
Well, there's an obvious overlap between the cases in that Hobby Lobby is directly targeted at women, and Harris v. Quinn, the facts of the case focused on a largely female workforce, and the decision in Harris v. Quinn in effect disempowers them, which is the theme that seems to be running through the actions of the Supreme Court, to disempower women. But there are real specifics. Well, two things. One is that the Hobby Lobby case, I think, is far more dangerous for the country as a whole, which is not to minimize the dangers connected to Harris v. Quinn. Just as Gerald was saying, the Hobby Lobby case is a vote for theocracy. And so the Harris v. Quinn, what's dangerous here is that it does open up the door for the removal of what are called agency fee or service fee arrangements, through which workers who choose not to join a union are obligated to pay what's called a service fee that covers the cost of representation.
Because they're still getting the benefits from the contract.
They're not just getting the benefits. What the law, the National Labor Relations Act, says with no qualification that the union is obligated to fairly and equitably represent all workers in a bargaining unit, irrespective of whether they're union members.
Right.
Thus, in the absence of an agency shop agreement or service fee, what you'll have is, and you have this in right-to-work states, you have it in the federal sector, which is something I'm directly familiar with, a situation where workers receive the benefits, they get representation, and they don't have to pay anything. I mean, that would be the equivalent of saying to taxpayers, if you don't like the policies of government, you don't have to pay taxes. But not only that, you'll still get public education, health care, police and water and fire. I mean, it's absurd. No other institution in this country would permit this. Yet it is permitted here, and that's in order to undermine unions. It's clear.
Right. I understand that commentary I read said that the court had created a whole new set of employees. There used to be union and non-union, and now there's quasi-union.
Well, that distinction actually has existed in a peculiar way for a long time. Now, Justice Kagan, in her opposition to the majority decision, did something very interesting. She basically says that the Supreme Court did not and could not overturn the precedent that permits agency shop, that the precedent was now very well founded, and that there was no basis upon which the majority could do this. In the streets, we would say that she was chumping the majority, and so we'll see whether or not we can hold this off. But the unions are going to have to understand that a response to this really must mean organizing workers. It can't simply be yet another court battle.
Right. Dr. Prine, I want to go back to something in your statement after the ruling. You said you raised the issue of how Hobby Lobby is an example of why we need a national single-payer health care system rather than an employer-based insurance. Can you expand on that right now?
Yeah, it's so unfair that some women have access to really great health insurance coverage that covers all of their preventive services and their illness services and so on. And then others have these new plans that have come through the Affordable Care Act that are so bare bones and cover them so minimally. And now the one thing that we were really excited about, that all preventive medicine, including birth control, was going to be covered, is even now undermined. We need it. It totally points to that we need a single-payer health plan in this country so that everybody gets good quality health care with equal access for all, not, you know, budget plans, plans where you're paying out of pocket more than what the insurance company is getting. You know, it's just so unfair. And the Affordable Care Act is a donation to private insurance companies for government funding. Whoever heard of such a thing? And there's no other developed country in the world that has a plan like this. The government pays for health care for people. It's considered a right. And in our country, we like earn it doubly. We earn it through our work, through our employment, and then we have to pay all these co-pays and deductibles when we go to access services. It's okay. Just a terrible system.
Okay. If you're just tuning in, this is the Thursday edition of Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm your host, Esther Averam, and I've been speaking with prolific author and activist Professor Gerald Horn, Dr. Linda Prine, who practices family medicine and gynecology in New York, and is co-founder of the Reproductive Health Access, and Bill Fletcher, labor and international activist and author. I think that Bill and Gerald will stay with me, but I want to thank Dr. Prine for joining us. When we come back, it's your turn. We're going to continue to discuss these issues, and you can call in at 202-588-0893 to comment on this, what I consider, rogue Supreme Court, on the issues of women's reproductive rights, labor rights, and the future of the labor movement. And don't forget the question I raised earlier at the top of the show. What are some of the issues that you think that we can get behind as a community? How can we raise our voices as a community, as a community of listeners here in the nation's capital? 202-588-0893 will be the number to call. And thank you, Dr. Prine. And we'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to the Thursday edition of Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition, where we lift up voices of social justice and activism. This is our pre-July 4th show, and we're just listening to Jimi Hendrix's version of the Star-Spangled Banner from Live at Berkeley, recorded May 30th, 1970. Bill, you were shaking your head. I don't know if you was like...
Oh, no, I love it. I mean, it's the most remarkable version I've ever heard of Stassi Mangabeira.
Okay, during the first half of the show, we explored two Supreme Court rulings this week, Hobby Lobby and Harris versus Quinn, that strike a blow at the rights of women and labor. So many are asking, how can we stop this court that keeps giving corporations more power and giving people less power? Staying with me is labor and international activist and author Bill Fletcher, who is also host of his own show, Arise, on Fridays at 9 a.m.
That's right.
And the author and activist Gerald Horn, still on the line. Are you there, Gerald?
Yes.
Okay, great. All right. Do we have a caller? I think we do have the phone lines are filled up. And we'll go to calls, but we will also continue discussing. Caller, just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Oh, hi, yeah. Joe in Rockville, Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what's going on here is really a fundamental misunderstanding of what the rule of law really means. I mean, for people to call this a rogue Supreme Court is really kind of absurd, because if you look at both the Hobby Lobby case and the union case, it's more about freedom than anything else. I mean, to be forced to join a group is just, used to be, liberals used to hate that type of concept, and now the left is all for mandating and force and expanding government power as opposed to limiting government power. And basically what the Supreme Court decisions, some of them have done, is actually limiting government power. Calling them a rogue just doesn't understand what the rule of law really means. I mean, to be able to say that simply because you participate in home health care, you have to be forced to join a group that you don't agree with, that doesn't really stand up for you, and all of this other kind of stuff is just absolutely absurd. And Kagan's argument, I mean, I'm an attorney, and Kagan's argument about there's no basis to overturn the 74 decision is also just laughable. I mean, by that standard, we overturned Dred Scott, we've overturned many, many very bad Supreme Court premises.
Okay. Thank you, Joe, for calling.
I would like to have a follow-up, because I could anticipate what's going to happen. It's all going to be...
No, that's okay. We everybody gets their turn. We have the lines filled up, and I'll give Gerald and Bill a chance to respond.
Well, let me start. I think that... I actually wouldn't call the court rogue. I'd call them just straight-up reactionary. And in this case, the notion... This is not about freedom. Let's be very clear. The workers that petitioned the Supreme Court, backed by the National Right to Work Committee, their objective was to create a situation where they did not have to pay for the things that they were gaining, including the basic representation. The National Labor Relations Act, and I'd say to the caller, since the caller claims to be a lawyer, knows that the National Labor Relations Act mandates that unions must represent all workers. So the fact that a worker may disagree with the policies of the union is irrelevant. The union is obligated by law. And where do you think the resources come from to represent them? Do you think that there's magic out there? Do you think that they can just come up with money out of nowhere? There have to be resources to represent people, even if those individuals don't agree with the union. I've seen so many times where workers who have refused to join a union, who've disagreed with the union, when they are in trouble, what do? They don't go home and pray. They go to the union and ask to file a grievance.
Okay. Well, I want to make sure we get to our callers, but hasn't there been a trend recently around the same issue in terms of trying to deny funding to unions? I think one of the states, like Michigan, passed a law, over the objections of the electorate to kind of...
Right to work.
Yeah, to make the state a right to work state.
That's correct.
And this was a state where there were very powerful unions, though, the auto workers. So anyway, a lot of people believe that this decision is really part of the same trend and same effort by the conservative funded organizations to deny funding to unions, which are the only the only people standing at election time to give political funding, in opposition to the conservative funded groups. But anyway, 202-588-0893 is the number to call. Caller, you're on the line. Tell me your first name and where you're calling from.
I'm Remy. I'm calling from Northwest in Ward 1. Hi, Esther. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I just wanted to make two very quick points. I think in the Hobby Lobby case, the larger issue here, I mean, to me, it exposes the failure of the progressive movement here. As soon as that decision came down, there should have been an effort to say we're going to organize a boycott of Hobby Lobby. That should have been the first thing that was done. You know, if they want to roll like that, I mean, they don't have to provide that service to their employees. We don't have to shop there.
Well, don't shop. You start the boycott.
Yeah, I get it going. And the second point on that union thing, the basic premise here to me, I was a member of the communications workers for many years. If you accept the job, you've also accepted the responsibility to pay the union. You know, that's my view of both. I'll get off the phone and take your comments and that of your guest.
Okay. Gerald, you know, you didn't have a chance to weigh in before. Did you have any comments on the call so far?
Well, briefly, I compliment the previous caller with regard to his idea of a boycott. It's something that needs to be followed up on. With regard to your first caller, he is railing against what he calls the expansion of government power, but those of us, particularly in the black community, have recognized historically that we rely upon the government to keep these races off our backs. And I get very nervous when I hear that kind of commentary coming out of Rockville, Maryland.
Oh, okay. Well, there's all kinds of people who live in the DMV. Okay, 202-588-0893 is the number to call. I'm going to go back to the callers. Tell me your first name and where you're calling from.
My name is Star, and I'm calling from Northwest D.C.
Hi, Star.
Hi, how are you, Esther? Mm-hmm. Great show. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to comment with regard, just by way of background, with regard to the decision. The decisions that were made, I mean, there's definitely a link between the pro-corporate stance and the strike against women's rights. One of the things that happens with women in any kind of capitalist system that's dominated by a corporate class is that it becomes very, very important for the corporate state to be able to control the reproductive lives of women. It doesn't even matter what the individual's position is on whether it's moral or not moral to have to use birth control or have abortions. But it's very, very important to keep women in a position of at least semi-dependence on men and in the family unit, because the family unit is the incubator for each generation of workers. Women, in particular, historically have done a lot of free labor, socializing the workers for those corporations for their workforce, and it's unpaid labor. And labor, and women also, to the extent that they're kept out of the job market and in a position of dependence, they form a kind of reserve army of labor that can be called in at different times to, say at war or whatever. They can fill in the gaps, and so they're keeping them, partially disempowered at least. You know, is very, very important to the state in order to control the function that they perform for the corporate state. And I think that if you understand that, you can understand, you know, the links in a lot of these positions. And unfortunately, it's not just a conservative position. Even the what are called liberals, when push comes to shove, they'll only go so far in terms of really wanting to free people up, often for, you know, really creative kinds of family building and other kinds of rights, because unfortunately liberals by definition are also very dependent on the capitalist state for their position. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you for calling, Star. And you know, what she said reminded me of another piece in the Sarah Jeffrey article I read, when she talks about how both these decisions keep women's work or work in the home, it keeps it considered not as work. Maybe more the Harris v. Quinn case that it, so anyway. Thank you, Star. 202-588-0893 is the number to call. I'll go to our next caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Yes, my first name is Paul, and I'm calling actually from the Beltway.
Okay, well, drive carefully.
Well, I would tend to agree very much with the comment that's been made that, in fact, that people need to pay for services provided. And I find too often that they talk about the issue of democracy and stuff on this line to try to justify the Supreme Court's ruling. But people have the right not to work under a union contract. They have the right not to work where there's a union. They can quit and go somewhere else if that's what they choose they want to do. But too often, they like the benefits that comes from what labor negotiations have brought about in this country. And so that's why they choose to work in that respect. The other thing is that there was a majority of the people who worked in these companies that wanted to work under the union contract and wanted to be represented by labor. And I thought this country was all about democracy and the will of the majority. I mean, obviously not everybody votes for what representative that may be in office wherever they may live, but the majority of the people evidently did, or the proponents of the majority did, depending on how many big people were running at a given time. And so this argument that the gentleman from Rockville was trying to make did not make any sense to me as well.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much for your call. 202-588-0893 is the number to call. We have our phone lines are filled up. Caller, just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Hi. This is Jabari from Northwest D.C.
Hi, Jabari.
How you doing? I just wanted to talk about the genesis of this and how we really have to think about creating an overriding vision that will replace the existing reality that most people accept. This country and this world presently is run by a small group of white males who have created a vision and ideology that is based on their control and use of resources, and everyone else has adopted it and have basically bought into it. We have to admit that first. We have to admit what the problem is, because most people are complicit with it. We bank at Bank America. We have money in Wells Fargo. When you have a march on the mall, as soon as the mall is over, those people rush into Starbucks or McDonald's or Taco Bell. So we're complicit. The system could not exist without our behavior that supports it. So what we have to do is first admit that we are a major part, if not the part, we are the system, and figure out all the different ways in our everyday life that we will resist complying with the system. Second, and this is the most important thing, we have to get out of a protest mentality where we are always playing defense and decide that we are going to be in control. In the 60s, we talked about black power, women power. We don't even hear the vernacular, that voice of empowerment, only from the sense of defense, where we are resisting. No, we have to be in control, which means that you have to be willing to take, and you have to be willing to hurt people who are going to try to hurt you. And so until we have a vision that most people can buy into, that replaces this vision, that's sustainable, then we will always have these shows, because the people who are in control have a vision, and they are working their vision every day, and we don't.
Okay, well, I think we're trying every day to develop our vision and develop our plans. I think many of us are working in organizations, maybe not all together, but people are working in their own way to combat various serious issues out here today. And, you know, I wanted us to think about, on this show, some issues, struggles, campaigns that we can get behind as a station, as a listenership, you know, moving forward. You know, maybe some callers can suggest some of those things as well. 202-588-0893 is the number to call. I think we still have a caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Jean, Montgomery County.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Jean.
Hi, I'm a union member. And for years, we've been trying to get permission to have a new union come in here. And from what I understand, this union is ran by the county, and they won't allow it. Now, I'm sure that has to be against the law.
Hmm. Well, Oh, thank you for that comment. Did you want to say anything?
Yeah, I mean, from a technical standpoint, the union can't be run by the company.
County.
The county. But if there are disagreements that you and others have with the union, the first thing is to try to take them up within the organization. And the second thing is that you have a right to decertify the union if you feel fundamentally that there's a problem, and then you bring in another one. So, I mean, there are legal options, but the first option that I always recommend is that when people have issues, they take them up internally, and there's usually very clear mechanisms to do that.
Okay. Well, you're listening to the Thursday edition of Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition, and we're taking calls while we still talk to Bill Fletcher and Gerald Horn on the line. We're taking your calls at 202-588-0893. We're going to go to a brief break, and then we'll be right back.
Let's get majestic, electric communities. Can you connect with the revolution of the record? Re-expression, liberated, manifested, superseding all the season that has been invested in the misdirected. With a new perspective, can you get the message? We are more than extra, futures in the present. Music is the essence, fly than our stretch wings. It's got an extreme. More strikes than Adidas, radiant light, warm with gold gravitas. Old troops, they flow flatter than Mardi Gras. Old troops, we know, they on the platypus. If we live it, love it, and learn, gotta get it, gotta give it, struggle to earn. Phonetic vibe for freedom, brothers should learn. Marathonic, we run, as we return. And understanding, all my brothers standing beside. Positivity, shared, the planet arise. Anything else, only cannibalize. Spiritual selves, sister, let's travel the skies. Can you feel the energy? Can you feel the energy? Can you feel the energy? Spread love, no soul is your enemy. Can you feel the energy? Can you feel the energy? Can you feel the energy? Spread love, no soul is your enemy. Feel the energy, elevate with the melody. Celebrate with development, sound makes the Elohim. Shackles and eyes dissolve, it's ours. This is evolved beyond the prisons of laws. Really irrelevant.
And welcome back to the Thursday edition of Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition, where we lift up voices of social justice and activism. We're talking today about the Supreme Court, women's productive rights, labor rights, and the future of the labor movement, and any other issues you think are related. 202-588-0893 is the number to call. You were actually just listening to composition by, I just know her as Ola Cole, Ola Yamika Cole, whose work from her new album, Lefe, was performed last Friday as part of the jazz festival. But anyway, I wanted to play some of that. So we're getting back the callers. I think there's someone on the line. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Good morning, Esther. How are you?
I'm fine. Who's calling?
This is Tyrone from Northwest Washington, D.C.
Hi, Tyrone.
I'm trying. Listen, number one, I agree with your guest totally about the labor and also what's happened with all this unfortunate situations, cases that are coming down from the Supreme Court, these rulings. Listen, we're going to continue to have these kinds of judges as long as people don't get out and vote. If they don't get out and vote, they have to get out and vote. Voting is very essential to getting the kind of congressional leadership in office where we can get these types of clowns out of there and get some people on the Supreme Court. It has some very sound judgment sense. We got a few of them up there, but for the most part, Scalia and let's say the conservative ones in general, they're not the ones that we need up there. And we need to get some congressmen and senators who will support President Obama and who will support his nominees for the Supreme Court.
Okay.
And otherwise, if we don't, we're going to continue down this slippery slope. And I thank you for taking my call.
Okay, and thank you for calling, Tyrone. Well, Gerald, he raises some important issues, and I want you to have a chance to talk about the Supreme Court in general. You know, not only these two decisions, but there was actually another labor-related decision where they refused to seat President Obama's appointments to the National Labor Relations Board. And I was wondering if you just had any more comments about this particular Supreme Court and its direction. Oh, okay. Did we lose him? Yeah. Okay. Well, Bill, did you want to speak to that?
Yeah, what you're talking about are the recess appointments issues.
Yeah.
And so the basically what the court did is that it's reversed years and years of precedent when it comes to recess appointments. And the aim is, again, it's another right-wing assault. And it's really interesting because these challenges, when that first caller talked about essentially the expansion of government, no one in the political right were making these kind of criticisms of the second Bush administration. As it expanded, as it went rogue. But under Obama, they have decided to make that sort of target. So this attack on the recess appointments was not simply an attack on the National Labor Relations Board. It was an attack on the ability of the president to actually get something done.
Right, because he had so many vacancies unfilled because Congress fails to approve any of them.
Right, because it's not that their agenda is tied up. It's because they are obstructing the ability to get something done.
Okay. Gerald, I think that you've rejoined us. No, he's not. Oh, okay. I thought he...
It's like the phone's down.
Oh, okay. All right. So I do think we have another caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Good morning. My name is Tespa, and I'm calling from Arlington, Virginia.
Hi, Tespa.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay.
Good morning to your great guest.
Good morning.
Good morning, my brother. I want to say, if the Supreme Court is in doubt, if people think the Supreme Court is not doing justice, the whole system is in doubt. Because when the executive branch does something wrong, you take the executive to the Supreme Court. Once the Supreme Court has become, in the public eye, unfair and unjust, then the whole system is not legitimate anymore. Once people start doubting the legitimacy of the Supreme Court, the whole system is illegitimate. Once people come to believe that, no more people will live in the system. They will go to violence. America will become the rest of the world. America becomes like the third world, where nobody believes in the justice system. People start taking things into their hands. That invites violence. Violence in America could be what we see, just like the rest of the world. America becomes a place of war.
Okay.
And violence. Do you want that? That's what we should ask the right wing. That's what we should ask the justices. Do we want violence in America? I don't think nobody wants that. I don't think it's good for the country. I don't think it's good for the rest of the world. For the rest of the world, they better think twice.
Okay. All right, Tespa, thanks for calling in. And so actually we'll have to wrap up now. I want to thank Bill Fletcher, Gerald Horn, and Dr. Linda Prine for joining me this morning, and all the callers. That will do it for me for this Thursday edition of Community Watch and Comment. Special thanks to Mike Nasella on the board, our very capable engineer. And again, thank you so much for listening and calling in and supporting. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can also listen to all of our shows archived there. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at On the Ground Show. Stay tuned for Askia Muhammad with the news, followed by Krista Property on Don't Forget the Blues. Peace.